Mashabane, that she will not be able to attend the Tuesday meeting due to ill health. There's another one from the MJC Mashiko Dlamini, will not be able to attend due to the fact that she has attended the departmental tour in New York. There's another one for the M Squadra that will join us late. Any other apology? There's also an apology for the committee secretary, who's also ill. Any other apology?
Chair, may I apologize, but just for clarity on this issue of medical certificate. Lucy was sick the other day, now our minister is sick, they need someone.
What do you want the committee to do? We have received the apologies, then what further are we expected to do? To say that they are not sick? We're not doctors, unfortunately.
I don't know if they're...
Honorable Magadi.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I think it will be the first time that the committee is meeting doctors that later. If someone is here in this committee who just noted the committee, not that we need something that shows that someone is ill, it will be the first time here.
I will not allow the committee to discuss the apologies. Let me note the apologies and proceed. Another one,
Chairperson, we need to address the issue raised by Honorable Peter, because it creates, that question creates doubt with the apologies. It creates a very wrong impression in my mind. To think that the minister is that way, she's not, she doesn't want to come to the committee.
No.
And I think that is wrong.
Honourable members, can you note the apologies and proceed? But there's nothing for us to discuss the apologies. We know why we are here. We just note the apologies that we received and proceed with our meeting. Honourable members, the minutes of the 7th of March were circulated to honourable members. Can you look at page one of the minutes? There was a full bench of members in our previous meeting. Page one of the minutes. Page two of the minutes. Adoption of the amendments, honorable members. Honorable
Matheson. I'm not for the adoption of the amendments
of the 7th. Honorable Magada is more for the adoption of the minutes of the 7th of March 2018. Any seconder? Honorable Matheson.
board chair, with everybody else, I duly second the proposal.
Seconded by
Honourable Mandela. Honourable members, can I make a ruling that we look at the minutes? If there's any matters arising, you will note that so that you proceed without business of the day. Do we agree? If there are any matters arising, so that we give Dr. Trussell enough time to present, you can note. Then in our next committee meeting, we can raise the issue. Honourable members, we are aware that in our previous meeting of the 7th of March 2018, we were supposed to receive the briefing by Dr. Klassens on the findings and the recommendations of the high-level panel with regards to the implementation of all the legislation which were passed post-1994, whether the legislation that were passed did have any impact in changing the lives of the South African citizens. So this was a decision which was taken by the Speaker's Forum. The high-level panel, which was led by Palima Mutante and also some experts in various sectors. So Dr. Klassen was responsible for all the land-related matters, as she was part of the panel. So in our previous committee meeting, we agreed that we have to invite her to be part of the meeting to present the findings and the recommendations. If members will have some clarification questions, I will give them the opportunity to do so. Therefore, without a waste of time, and I've emphasized in our previous meetings that the high-level panel report has got findings and recommendations, not resolutions. Recommendations are recommendations. Therefore, I will invite Dr. Klassen to make the presentation on the findings of the public participation process which was conducted, and also the recommendations of the high-level panel. Over to you, Dr. Klassen.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ngwenya Mabila, and thank you very much to the committee for inviting me to give this presentation. I'm really honoured by your invitation, just as I was honoured to be a member of the high-level panel and to hear rural people and urban people speak so eloquently in the public hearings that the panel conducted in the 9 provinces of South Africa. I'm deeply aware of the irony of me being a white person talking about land at this stage of our history. And I just want to say that I don't think that that should go without comment, but I'm one member of a panel of initially 17 people, it ended up being 14 people. Three of the people appointed to that panel were white, but the panel really deeply considered all of these recommendations about land, and it reflects the view of the panel. The recommendations reflect the view of the panel and not me. There was a land subcommittee, and on that land subcommittee, which we call the working group, was former President Mutante, Dr. Terence Mbembe, Malcolm Damon, and initially also the former governor, Tito Mboweni. So I'm also aware that the time is going to come very soon where young black people replace old white people like me. And if it weren't for young black people this morning, we would never have had this PowerPoint available to be shown. So I think times are changing. So just to start off with the letter of invitation. The letter of invitation asked me to speak about policy and legislative impediments to both tenure and redistributive land reform and mechanisms that can be put in place to address them. And it said that of great importance is the implementation of the Ngonyama Trust Act. Then it asked me to speak about settlement support to land reform beneficiaries, and finally mechanisms to enhance parliamentary oversight and accountability to ensure the realisation of land rights enshrined in the Constitution. So I'm going to start with the issue of parliamentary oversight. Basically, I've divided this into three different presentations because I'm hoping that we can stop and have questions after each. So the first one is really starting with that question of parliamentary oversight, looking at the proposed National Land Reform Framework Bill and the questions of redistribution and settlement support. The second set of slides is about tenure security, and that includes discussions of the Communal Land Tenure Bill and the Ngonyama Trust. And then the last set of slides is about restitution and CPAs. And basically, I'm going to have to really rush through these slides because you'll see that the panel did a lot of analysis and actually was asked to draft indicative bills which are included in the report on the website on the report. So I can't do justice to all that detailed work, but obviously both myself and other members of the panel would be very happy to come back and discuss specific pieces of specific recommendations as the committee invites us to do so. So maybe just to start really with this question of how can Parliament exercise oversight? And one of the things which the panel noted is the lack of policy coherence in relation to that. But there's been no white paper since 1997. And therefore, it becomes incredibly difficult for members of Parliament to measure bills and the content of bills against agreed policy objectives. And what we've seen in the last 9 years or so is a problem of constant ad hoc policy changes, some of which are not even made public, and yet they're implemented and resources are spent on those. In the public hearings, people kept on complaining how the goalposts are shift constantly in relation to land reform grants and criteria for qualification. And what we've seen is the budget reallocated away from laws on the statute book, which say that the minister must provide funds for on and off farm settlements for farm workers, and those things not being implemented, and yet new policies that are not adopted by Parliament and are not even made public attract large sections of the budget, as we'll see later in some of the slides. And we've seen the Auditor General has commented on this issue of the budget being spent for issues that are not approved by Cabinet or approved or mandated by legislation. So that makes it impossible for members of Parliament to monitor the budget expenditure and to keep track of the new scheme. So unless you've got policy coherence, there's a real danger of getting lost in the detail, and especially if the laws are not correctly sequenced. So what the panel reported across all of the different working groups is that Parliament is extremely dependent on the executive to draft laws. And in fact, it needs drafting capacity so it can actually operate more independently of the executive and fulfill both its legislative and its oversight role more effectively. When the panel reported to the Speakers Forum, we reported halfway through the process. We got a very positive response, and the Speakers Forum said to us, don't make vague recommendations. We want you to go and start actually drafting bills that address the serious problems that were reported in the public hearing, because all the speakers of the provinces attended the public hearing. And so they were very concerned about land reform resources, whether farms or budgets being diverted away from poor people to benefit particular kinds of elites. And the evidence of increased SIU investigations in relation to who farms have actually gone to. An example of the difficulty that Parliament faces in relation to how bills are sequenced relates to the current CPA amendment bill. That bill is being processed, and yet the communal land tenure bill, the draft communal land tenure bill, has not been tabled yet. And that bill would explain exactly the proposed amendments to the CPA amendment bill. And yet, members of Parliament don't have the communal land tenure bill in front of them, which would explain some of the proposed amendments and would enlighten members of Parliament as to whether they actually agree with what the ultimate purpose of the amendments to the Communal Property Association Act are. As I said, the Speaker's Forum asked us to come up with draft bills, and one is the National Land Framework Bill, and there is an indicative draft of that bill on the website. And what that bill seeks to do is to provide, well, it focuses in on redistribution, but it seeks to provide coherence between the three legs of land reform, being redistribution, restitution, and tenure. As we know, redistribution and restitution are meant to be discrete programs, but tenure is cross-cutting. There are various types of tenure insecurity, people in the former homeland, people on the Wanyama Trust land, people on the farm, people in the shack settlements around the city. So it's impossible to have a one-size-fits-all solution to the various tenure problems we have. But tenure is also cross-cutting because it relates to the form of land rights that people will get through redistribution and restitution. So what we analysed is that there have been delivery failures in relation to restitution and redistribution, the allegations of leak capture of the land reform budget and farm, the imposition of this large group model and strategic partners on big groups of beneficiaries who then get locked into internal disputes and have no agency relative to the strategic partners. We heard this in every single province. People complaining about having been lumped together, hundreds of people meant to be farming one farm, and then strategic partner imposed on them who cut them out of all decision-making processes. The other thing we heard everywhere were long, long delays in people acquiring land, even when there's been signed agreements that they should acquire land for restitution or redistribution, and many allegations that some claims are prioritized at the expense of others. The failures in tenure reform are different from the failures in restitution and redistribution. The failures in restitution and redistribution are failures of delivery. The failures in tenure reform have the impact of enabling dispossession of black people. And we witnessed and we were very eloquently told about how black people are being dispossessed of communal land through mining on their land and through other investment deals, that they are not consulted, their consent is not obtained, and no compensation is given to them. But we'll have a separate section on tenure insecurity. Then, obviously, there's an overlap between the delivery failures and the tenure issues. The relatively few people who do manage to obtain redistribution land remain tenants of the state. And that is the policy, that they won't get ownership because there seems to be no confidence that black people can farm, and so they will remain tenants until they can prove that they are farming the land productively. Yet, how can you farm land productively when you are one of 300 people on a former white farm, and when you have no enforceable rights against the CPA committee who may be misusing resources for their own benefit. And basically, we are saying that this model of redistribution makes agricultural productivity impossible. It's not a matter that people are bad farmers, it's a matter that the model doesn't. So what I'll briefly sketch here is how policy agendas and ideological positions have changed dramatically over time, and yet we still only have the 1997 white paper. We know about the slow pace of land redistribution. and the incredible tensions that that has created in our society. But maybe just to look at how policy shifted. From 1995 to 2000, we had the Settlement and Land Acquisition Grant. And that was means targeted. People qualified for that grant if they were poor, and you could get land both for agriculture or for settlements, so for livelihoods around the city. Then we shifted from 2000 to 2010 to the idea of market-based purchase, again, similarly, but a focus on commercial agriculture, trying to create a class of black farmers. And there, the more you could contribute, the bigger the grant that you got. And the focus then was purely on agriculture as opposed to livelihood strategies or settlements. And then from 2006 until now, you've had the PLUS policy, where there's no transfer of title. It's not means tested. And in fact, the DPME report on the recap policy showed that there are no selection criteria for who got multi-living grants under recap. And that, again, is only agriculture. But as black farmers are complaining, like, how can you be a successful farmer if you are a tenant? How do you access resources and how do you have security of tenure if you're only a tenant? Sadly, we've seen the pace of land redistribution slow down dramatically, with 2015 and 2016 being at the lowest level since 2000. And here you have the amount of land transferred through land distribution in hectares per year. And see that from 2016 and 2017, virtually none. And your high point was there in 2008. Gender is emphasized in all the policies, but women only are only 23% of the beneficiaries, although the data is very unclear, so it's incredibly difficult to measure who's getting what land. I mentioned the shift from the pro-poor bias to the very opaque selection criteria in the recap and development program. And here is the critical issue in this proposed land framework act, that there are no adequate criteria to measure who is benefiting. The Constitution provides that people must get equitable access to land, but members of Parliament cannot measure whether equitable access of land is being delivered, because there are no criteria against which to measure this, and there's no data to show who's actually getting the land, and is that addressing racial inequality, poverty inequality, and other forms of gender inequality. I'm sure you are familiar with the bad outcomes of redistribution. And the problem is, why are the outcomes so bad? And what we argue is that one's got to look at the kind of business plans imposed on people. The failure for agricultural production is put on the people, that they're fighting with one another, that they haven't got skills, that they can't manage. And yet the business plans are all about, they're all based on a model of large commercial agriculture with 300 families substituted for the previous white farmer. So there's a fundamental misfit between the vision of agriculture that is being pursued and the mechanisms that are being used to pursue it. And I won't stress this point, but people are very unhappy about the strategic partners imposed on them and their lack of access to the land itself, to budgets, their lack of agency. Many people say we are treated in the same way as we were during apartheid. We've got these white strategic partners who have no respect for us. And you've got a serious problem of post-transfer support and coordination between the Department of Rural Development and the Department of Agriculture. And that has been documented in repeated case studies. It is not a new problem. It wasn't difficult for us to discover it. It's in report after report after report. And then if you look at the budget, the top blue line is how there's a budget being spent, there's a budget being spent, and the bottom line is money that is going into grants for land acquisition. So the budget is no longer going into grants that enable people to acquire land. It's been spent for other purposes. And if you look at the reallocation of the land reform budget in 2016, AgriParks gets the biggest section of the budget. Is AgriParks an agreed policy? Is it governed by law and regulations? What oversight role can Parliament play in relation to AgriParks? And sadly, AgriParks is all about hubs where many, many tenders are made available. So a fundamental problem is we have no law defining who should get the land, how the land should be used, what the type and scale of farming should be. What about settlement? What about people who desperately want land near the cities to live on? What about multiple livelihoods? How will land reform address racial inequality? How should land be identified and acquired? Should redistribution be restricted to those properties that are offered for sale, i.e. no targeting? Or should there be area-based priorities? What rights should beneficiaries have? Should they be owners or should they be long-term investors? This lack of legal criteria and measures enables elite capture. It feeds into the lack of transparency and accountability. It makes oversight and monitoring evaluation very difficult because of the lack of the data against which to measure whether there's progress with providing equitable access to land. And of really fundamental importance, the failure of redistribution has led to the restitution program being swapped because people have given up with redistribution, and so they put in claims, restitution claims, and restitution claims are really limited to a court-based process where people can prove specific historical losses, not suited to people who are dispossessed, who are even dispossessed of their history, and who need land, and who need equitable access to land. And that has really capsized the restitution program. So we put a lot of work into drafting not a detailed bill, but an indicative bill of what you could do to address these kinds of problems. And it's an annexure to the report, and it's L1. And probably we should have printed that out. I'm sorry I didn't think of that, for people to have a look at it. But really that needs a full discussion of its own. And what it tries to do is to provide coherent cross-cutting guiding principles in respect of redistribution, restitution, and tenure, how each one relates to the other. Seeks to define what equitable access to land means and criteria to measure progress. Sets out beneficiary criteria, beneficiary selection criteria, and clear institutional arrangements, particularly at district level, where actually people in the district would be able to provide direction about who needs what land and what land is available. In the hearings, we heard person after person stand up and accuse officials of the Department of Land Reform by name, by district, of being rude to them, disrespectful to them, and being involved in processes of corruption. And they kept on saying, we, the people, want to be able to direct this process. We have lost confidence in officials and politicians. They said politicians are like vultures who swoop down to steal our land and to steal the budget for land reform. And then finally, many, many people complained about how they are locked in legal disputes, how they spend all their money paying lawyers because they've been lumped into these big groups. And what we need then is a land rights protector, something like a public protector who can deal with these disputes and claims without people having to go to court. Then on the issue of post-settlement support, The panel didn't investigate this in too much detail because we were really looking at the impact of laws, and we were looking really at the lacuna, the lack of a law in relation to this issue. But just to say that our conclusion is that agriculture cannot be productive if it's based on this large group model, and that we need to subdivide land and provide family-based rights. The Subdivision of Agricultural Land Act prohibits the subdivision of agricultural land. There's a major constraint on breaking up big farms and making them available to families or small groups. This Parliament passed a repeal act that repealed that act, but that act has never, that repeal act has never been brought into operation. Chinito and I disagree why. I think the President, the then President, Thabo Mbeki, didn't sign it. He says the date for coming into operation was just never made clear. But whatever the reason, Parliament passed this law, and it has got stuck. And it has remained a major impediment to breaking up these large landholdings so people can have strong individual rights. Then all the agricultural support that is provided is geared to the model of commercial farming. There's no extension targeting emerging farmers and small farmers. We've got a tragic breakdown of the agricultural colleges. Colleges like Fort Cox in the Eastern Cape that used to train brilliant Abalini extension officers who were very involved with co-ops that were very successful on the ground. And then we've got a really severe problem of marketing. In hearing after hearing, people talked about how these value chains are completely closed together. That the co-ops buy from the existing entrenched white farmers and sell on, and you can't break into this value chain. Well, through the Competition Commission, a whole lot of incentives could be created and regulations could be brought into bear to say that big shopping centres, for example, must allow local markets with locally produced vegetables to be sold. So there are imaginative ways in which that value chain can be broken down, and if it isn't, it's going to always exclude newcomers in the agricultural sector. So really what is stark is that there's lack of a vision of an integrated approach supporting both small-scale and large-scale farmers with targeted support for small-scale farmers. We've seen the wool growers co-op in the Eastern Cape and the extraordinary success there of small-scale farmers producing wool and changing livelihoods. So this is possible with the right kinds of programs. So that is the end of the first presentation. It is the longest, obviously. But I wonder if we should pause here to discuss these issues before going on to the other two.
Another one is that representation. Can I allow the government to make all the presentation? Then we engage with it.
To the sections in the Constitution which provide for security of tenure. Section 35(6) states that a person or community whose tenure of land is legally insecure as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to the extent provided by an Act of Parliament either to tenure to be legally secure for comparable reasons. So that covers everybody who doesn't have a legally secure right. That's everyone in the former homeland who has de facto occupation of land, but not legal security. It covers people in the informal settlements who have de facto rights to land, but who, because of racial discrimination, didn't have security at all. It covers farm workers and labour tenants who, because of racially discriminatory laws, didn't have their tenure. Section 25(9) stipulates that Parliament must pass legislation to get a better solution. Parliament is in breach of both Section 25.6 and Section 25.9 in that it has not yet passed legislation to give effect to Kenyan security in the former homeland, and that is 17 million South Africans. Just some history here, that just as colonialism and apartheid was it also denied black people rights in land by imposing a discriminatory tenure system that created a second-class system of off-register and largely informal rights to land. And there is a fundamental correlation between vulnerable forms of tenure and the geography of racial inequality. A bit later, I'll come to a slide which shows the difference between the former Bantustans and the rest of South Africa in relation to poverty and deprivation. It's absolutely stark, as is the inequality between people living in the shacklands around the city and people living in the city. And what both of those groups have in common is that the people who are poor and excluded have no recorded rights to the land. So because of Section 25.6, Parliament passed the Interim Protection of Informal Land Rights Act in 1996, which is a holding mechanism until comprehensive law could be enacted to secure vulnerable tenure rights. That law has still not been enacted. IPILRA, however, is potentially an extremely significant and strong law, because what it provides is that no one may be deprived of an informal right to land without their consent, except by expropriation. That is the formula used in the property clause, and it elevates informal rights to land to the status of property rights. The Act defines what an informal right to land is, and it includes custom and usage and all the people living in the former homeland, as well as beneficial occupation of land in the city, which is established in practice but not secured yet in law. So it requires that rights that are currently insecure because of past discrimination must be treated as property rights. It requires that people be consulted, that they must consent, and that they must be compensated if their informal rights to land are changed in any way. This act is routinely ignored by the department. The former Director General told me he didn't even know this existed, and it has been ignored and abrogated by the previous Minister of Land Affairs, who has been reluctant to renew it year on year, and more than that, has ceded his power and authority and his obligation to informal rights holders, to traditional leaders, in contravention of the law and in contravention of his fiduciary duty to the people in that land. So after IPILRA, we had the Communal Land Rights Act of 2004, which saw a change in direction. It saw traditional councils becoming land administration committees, and it provided for the transfer of title from the state to traditional communities. Now, these traditional communities are the tribes that were created in terms of the 1951 Bantu Authorities Act, which existed wall to wall as a unit of local government in the former Bantu Country. It enabled the minister to endorse the title deeds belonging to trusts and CPAs and also land buying syndicates over to the larger encompassing tribes. The act was struck down by the Constitutional Court after various groups of people argued that it undermined their right to tenure security by vesting decision-making power over their land at the level of the traditional council. So some of the people who were applicants were people who bought land before 1913, who said that their title deeds, since they bought the syndicates, would now be vested in traditional councils who in some instances had been created in the 70s, for example in the form of Kwandebele, and given control over land that they had previously bought. But it also included groups of people who see themselves as part of customary communities, who says that in terms of customary law, land rights is more at the family level, and decision-making is decentralized, and this would take all of that decision-making power and vest it at the level of superimposed traditional councils. So you had a range of different avenues. The Constitutional Court struck down the Communal Land Rights Act on the basis that the wrong procedure had been followed, that there hadn't been adequate public participation, but the Gauteng High Court had struck it down on substantive grounds, saying that instead of enhancing security of tenure and property rights, it undermined them because decision-making authority is a component of your property rights and your security of tenure. And if that's taken away from you and vested at another level, it undermines your property rights. So although the Act was struck down in 2010, it's only in 2017 that a draft communal land tenure bill has been published for comment to deal with this issue. But in the meantime, government has treated traditional leaders as if they are the owners of communal land. This is particularly the Department of Mineral Resources, who advises mining houses that they must sign deals with traditional leaders. Yet only the Minister of Rural Development and Land Affairs, as the nominal owner of most of this land, has the legal authority to sign such deals, and only after he has obtained the consent of the people affected in terms of the silver. The failure to uphold and enforce the silver has led to systematic expropriation. If we're talking about expropriation without compensation, that's been going on for the last 15 years, and it's been going on in the midst of the poorest and most vulnerable people who bore the brunt of forced removals and the land act. Basically, even though the MPRDA gives mineral rights to the state, mining companies still need to sign surface leases, and those surface leases provide their access onto the land. But it's those surface leases that are being negotiated between traditional councils and mining companies, with the minister having ceded his authority and his constitutional obligations to these traditional leaders. The Ngunyama Trust is also bound by Akilra, and the Trust has conceded this in its annual report, but it also makes claim that when it grants leases to third parties, the only consent that it obtains is that of the traditional council. It's a form called ITB2. So it doesn't even pretend that it consults and obtains the consent of the people whose land rights are affected by those leases. This means that people don't get compensation because they are not recognized as rights holders. Chair, can people read those for themselves? I mean, basically, just to say that the people speaking at the public hearing spoke incredibly eloquently and incredibly bravely. They were filmed. Everything they say is on YouTube. The YouTube is on the high-level panel site. But this is what a person said in the Pumalanga. Here is another person. This is a person from KwaZulu-Natal. I must tell you that some members of the panel went backstage and wept. They were so horrified to hear these testimonies. And it's partly these testimonies that meant that when we went to the speakers forum halfway through, they said, we see these problems. We need a legal framework that stops this stuff from happening. So what does the panel recommend? It recommends that the children must be enforced, but it should also be strengthened. Itura cannot be allowed to that, and it cannot be removed from the statute book, because then Parliament would be in flagrant breach of Section 25. So it's been kept there, but it's been ignored. So it needs to be strengthened, but also we need to assert and clarify the strength of customary land rights. Who does customary law best land rights in? We argue that it's mainly in the limited land. So we're saying if Jordan needs to be enforced, it needs to be beefed up, and other laws, like the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act and the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, need to be made explicitly subject to ICURA. So to amend ICURA, we've got very detailed recommendations there. It would be easy to make it permanent. You just delete the section which requires it to be removed. Now ICURA provides rights of occupation, use and access. This is very, very important, because it means people don't just get rights to their house or to their fields. They also have rights of access to grazing, to forest, to thatching grass. And that access right is very crucial in relation to mining, because it doesn't help if you give people title deeds to their houses, whereas you take all the common property and let mining take place on that. And a lot of people's livelihoods is in that common property. So what ICURA currently has, it has a community override. In order to try and be consistent with customary law, it says that rights that the community can decide about changes where other community members are going to benefit. But we recommend that the community override be removed in relation to occupation and use. There has been too much dispossession in the name of customary law. So people should have rights. They should not be able to be deprived of their houses and their fields, but that their rights of a share in the grazing land and in shared resources should be subject to community decision making. But the community must be defined as the people who are affected by the decision. That is the community who shares those rights. It can't be an overarching tribe of Bahasa Baha Fela of 200,000 people deciding about whether these people's grazing can be given over to mining. It's got to be the people who share that grazing. The other proposal that we make, which in a way should be interesting to the EFF Member of Parliament, is that ICURA provided that anyone who had been the beneficial occupier of land for 5 years prior to its enactment would have an informal right. That is because there was so much movement of people in the 80s where people were effectively, in a way, occupying land because of the crisis of inequality. And this sought to legitimize that process by saying those people have informal rights and they cannot be removed with their consent or by expropriation. It doesn't mean that people with tenants suddenly become owners. It doesn't mean that people with their disputes suddenly become owners. But if they've occupied the land, and if they were the owner openly for 3 years, then they should be treated as people with informal rights. And then ultimately we talk about introducing the Land Records Act, which is a proposal about recording informal rights. As long as they're not recorded, they are very, very vulnerable. Then we recommended, and this is a unanimous decision of the panel, after various round tables to which the Mbonyama Trust was invited and participated, that the Act should be repealed or amended. What we noted is that the Trust stopped the issuing of permission to occupy the certificate, which had been issued by the Department of Cooperative Government and Traditional Affairs in terms not of the Black Administration Act, but the 1992 KwaZulu-Natal Land Affairs Act and Regulations, which had been delegated by the Minister of Land Affairs to COGTA so that CTOs could continue to be issued in the interregnum before there was secure land tenure rights. The annual reports of that period, 2007-2008, explicitly explained this shift to leases as generating more income for the trust than the PTOs had previously done, and compares the small income that was generated by the PTOs with the much larger income that was generated by leases. As we saw, there have been advertisements inviting people to convert PTOs to leases, despite the fact that in terms of the upgrading of Land Tenure Rights Act of 1991, PTOs are upgradable to ownership. So you're taking a right that is upgradable to ownership by law and suggesting to people that they take a lesser form of right. So you're basically down upgrading customary ownership to tenancy. What we've seen is that many people don't understand that when they sign the voluminous lease application form, which is 40 pages long and in English, that it makes them tenants. They discover that the first time when the lease comes back with their name on it and the rent. And then people often say, well, we can't pay rent. This is our land. And then they're told, well, look, we'll resurvey your land. We'll make it smaller. And then your rent will be lower. So not only are people being downgraded to tenants, but their parcels of land are being made smaller in order to enable them to afford paying rent. And the lease explicitly provides that if you fail to pay rent, you forfeit the land and all the improvements that you or your family have built on that land, which will become the property of the land trust. The other thing that was perhaps most which the public hearing in Kudin Hotel focused on most of all is that people aren't consulted when a trust signs third party leases with mining companies, shopping malls, etc. Yet if Hilda says they must be consulted and they must consent to be expropriated, and the Ulanyama Trust Act itself says that the trust has to operate subject to pre-existing rights. These are pre-existing customary land rights which are simply ignored. The holders are not consulted and leases, long-term registered leases are entered into with developers. And as the trust has explained and it says on its website, the only consent that they require for these is a resolution of the traditional council. The other problem is the trust is issuing leases on land which people actually own. For example, the Nini community, who have a deed of grant going back to the 1800s, own their land in full ownership, and yet the trust is issuing leases and taking the revenue from those leases, for example. So let's look at customary law and communal tenure. We have the Communal Land Rights Act of 2004, the Communal Land Tenure Bill of 2017. Our Communal Land Tenure Bill of 2017 is much better drafted than the Communal Land Rights Bill, but it remains deeply, deeply ambiguous. Very, very, very difficult to understand what it's saying, because it promises everything to everybody. It promises traditional leaders ownership, it promises people use rights, but what it effectively does, it says that title of the outer boundaries of the land will be transferred to the traditional community, meaning tribe, and that tribe will then define the internal use rights. The only people who will have guaranteed internal use rights are people whose land was already subdivided at the time that the agricultural operation. My assumption is that those are the people who purchased land with the title, because were the act to try to incorporate land owned in terms of title deeds into this kind of model of tribal ownership, it would fall foul of properties. So what we've really got is, what we've struggled with as a panel is this question of ownership. that you have this Western construct of ownership, which is exclusive. It defines a piece of land, and it defines an owner. And it says the owner owns that piece of land exclusively. Once you've got title, you have got all. Once the CLTV transfers land to that traditional community, it will have full control of what happens next and whether or not it gives people registered rights inside its exclusively owned property. Customary systems of land, on the other hand, are inclusive. They allow for overlapping and nested rights. So you can have family members with rights, household head with rights, members of the village with rights. All of these rights operate at different levels and they coexist. And they provide for claims of need. So, you know, in the Western world, you've got this idea of socioeconomic rights that is meant to privilege claims of need. Whereas in South Africa, we already have a system of customary law which privileges rights to claims of need and allows for relative rights at different levels. So customary systems allow for shared uses of land and the prioritization of claims of need. Very, very different from this model of exclusive ownership as embodied in title deeds. Who owns the land according to customary law? Is it the families who have inherited it over generations, or is it traditional use? This issue is long disputed. Pixley Kaseme, Sol Saiki, went to court and gave evidence asserting that the land rights vest at family level in cases where they challenged traditional leaders who were expelling people or were selling communal land. This issue has been disputed by black litigants from the 1860s. Unfortunately, in front of courts whose objective was to prop up the model of autocratic chiefly power because the Governor General was the supreme chief of all nations. And we've actually got judgments which say, if we found for these people on the ground, what would it do to the power of the Governor General? We must find that the chiefs have autocratic power. But that's the question of the nature of those powers has been disputed historically. And you've got very, very different interpretations of customary law by the Constitutional Court and by laws such as the Communal Land Rights Act, the TLGFA, the TKLB. The Constitutional Court has issued a series of judgments talking about living customary law, which they see as participatory, bottom-up, and they contrast this with the colonial version of autocratic top-down laws. And they have used that interpretation to set aside old laws that provided for male primogeniture, to declare, in the Rochdorf case, the Rochdorf-Alice Court case, that customary law is ownership. They said, Supreme Court of Appeal said it's akin to ownership. They said it's not akin to ownership. It is ownership because it derives from a source of law that is equal to all other sources of law. Customary land rights are incredibly important because black people were denied statutory rights, they were denied common law rights. Most of the rights that people can assert, they can only assert in terms of the customary law. So, in legal terms, most of the land in the former homeland, not all of it, because there were lots of black people who bought land before the Land Act and through many, many exemptions from the Land Act, most of it is owned by the state as trustee, but its trusteeship is subject to people's pre-existing rights, as is the case with Ingonyama Trust land. The trusteeship is subject to customary law, it's subject to IPILRA, it's subject to PTOs. So the state cannot give away land that is subject to these pre-existing rights to anybody other than the people who have those rights. If it wants to give land to traditional leaders, it must first expropriate the land rights of the people living on that land. It cannot give away what it doesn't have, because actually, people have those rights. So, unfortunately, this notion of Western exclusive ownership has pervaded how many people see things, and it has led to a situation where instead of seeing themselves as a trustee, the trustees see themselves as the outright owner in the European sense, rather than as the custodian, the right held on behalf of other people. So what you've really got here is a default to colonial and apartheid principles. The basis of colonialism and apartheid was the exclusion of majority for the key assets, land, minerals, would be reserved for a white man to lease. We now have the state land leasehold policy, falling back on that very same model of state transmission, being used to deny black people ownership of the land that they get. And that has led to land, to people being extremely vulnerable. The customary land rights are not recorded. That makes people vulnerable to eviction. It also makes them invisible to the formal economy. Tenure vulnerability predicts poverty and inequality. It doesn't just reflect it. Here, if you look at the bottom of the slide and you look at the index of multiple deprivation, the former homeland, the index is 73%. The rest of South Africa is 42%. That shows you how deep the poverty is in the former homeland compared to the rest of South Africa. That blue is the map of poverty. Dark blue is the deepest poverty, pale blue is the next deepest poverty. That maps onto the former homeland. So what you've got here is, what we propose is that there should be a land record store to record people's rights, but not on the Winston model of exclusive ownership. To record people's rights through quick and affordable technologies like GPS that can be rolled out at scale. The deed registry system in South Africa is creaking under the strain of trying to fill the RDP houses. It was designed as a very intricate system for a minority of the population. It is failing to expand to include the majority of the population. So what we're talking about is recording people's rights wherever they are, whether they are members of CPAs, whether they are members of traditional communities, whether they are farm workers, and then giving people, giving those rights more content over time, but in the first place, just recording their rights, which could be done through combining the census and the GPS system. So we've got very detailed proposals for how this can be done by Siyabulela Marona, whom I'm sure would really like to explain this and explain why it's based on a customary model as opposed to a Western model. Finally, the panel in relation to tenure security, we looked at security of tenure for farm workers and labour tenants, and tragically, the evictions are continuing. There's been no prosecution of the landowners where illegal evictions have taken place, despite the fact that the law allows for this. The redistributive elements for on and off farm settlements are not enforced, despite there being a legal duty on the minister in terms of the law to provide a budget for on and off farm settlements. And we've seen that labour tenant claims have not been processed, and that's the subject of litigation, where it seems that the department believes, the minister, who knows, believed that it was unnecessary to comply with the law. The answer was we've changed our policy. And yet, all of government is bound to enforce and apply the law. So, in relation to farm workers and labour tenants, the main criticism there is that the law is not properly enforced. They do need slight amendments, which are covered by the panel, but the problem is one of lack of enforcement. So, Honourable Nguyenya, I've still got another final set of slides. Should we leave those for another day? Or should I rush through them as restitution and CPA?
Yes, go through it.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm very concerned that due to the time constraints here that we're going very fast through very, very crucial information. Chair, I don't want to disrupt what you had planned for the meeting, but I would strongly suggest if the presenter is available that we bring her back to the committee to engage her the points that she's raising. I think it's absolutely fundamental, some of the issues that have been raised here.
I agree with you, Honourable Walters, but for now, let's allow the doctor to present, because as Parliament, we're still going to deal with this report. This will not be the first time. So after the presentation, members will have time to go through the report again. When time comes, after we've been advised and guided on how do we approach this report, then we'll have to engage intensively on the report. But this is just for laying the foundation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, I'm going to go through this really fast then. Basically, restitution is a right guaranteed by Section 25(7) of the Constitution. And yet, we're in trouble with restitution. We've got more than 7,000 unsettled claims, more than 19,000 unfinalized old order claims. And if the new order claims that have already been lodged are processed at the current pace, they'll take 143 years to settle. And if land claims are reopened and the expected 397,000 claims are lodged, it will take 709 years to complete land restitution. So we are in trouble. There have been very alarming reports by the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, and also very alarming judgments by the Land Claims Court, basically saying that the Land Claims Commission, with the best will in the world, is not set up with the capacity to deal with the number of claims. That the officials have a lack of historical and legal training, that the record-keeping system has broken down, that claims are lost. The Genesis 2014 report says that in some provinces, less than 3% of files are in order. Now, how do you process restitution claims when you don't have claims then? And people have been waiting 20 years. There's also a problem of some invalid claims having been approved, especially after 1999, the 1999 amendment that was enacted in order to kind of expedite the process and allow for administrative approval. So we've seen many people know about the inconsistent prioritization, the Mala Mala settlement of 1.1 billion rand, yet the Commission's research indicates that the claim was not valid. Other transfers have held back for over 10 years despite signed approval, and evidence of increasing corruption. The Minister Mkhwanazi himself said that restitution is a honeypot for things. And then most tragically, and something that I haven't been aware of until the hearing, is that where there are disputes between different claimants, rather than resolve those disputes, the Commission has been under such pressure to move that it has actually amalgamated these different conflicting groups into one group who are then meant to share the restitution land. And yet they hate each other. So what we've seen is tragically, and this is especially the case in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, ethnic and tribal tensions because of this whole question of pre-colonial claims and Venga claims versus Tonga claims, and people talking about viewing graves in the Kruger National Park to prove that the Venga were there before the Tonga. So really worrying reinvigoration of ethnic tensions and a focus that has shifted away from who assisted it, when and how, to this idea of tribal claims that addressed the pre-1913 Wars of Conflict. When actually that is what redistribution was meant to have addressed, because those people tragically often don't have the historical detail to prove the specific history in a way that would qualify in terms of Section 35(7) of the Constitution. One of the groups who came to address, who came to speak at the high level panel in the Mpumalanga was a group called Mawuye, who have been waiting for land in Barberton that Boone McCain in 1998. Finally, they were allocated land 2 hours' drive away over very inhospitable terrain, only to be greeted by labour tenants who said, if you come onto this land, we will kill you. This is our land, we've occupied it for years, we've survived the whites, we've put in labour tenant claims, and yet that land just recently was allocated to the Mawuye CPA. So these things we heard are not exceptions. These things are happening everywhere. So there's a lack of attention paid to specific historical identity. No subdivision of land to give to particular families with particular strong claims. This lumping together of claims. And with very, very poor agricultural outcomes when you lump a whole lot of people together who don't like each other, have conflicting claims, and expect them to become good farmers. The problems were really severely exacerbated by the 2014 Amendment Bill. And some of these land claims court judgments indicate that certain valid claims have been held up, held back, so that counterclaims by traditional leaders were prioritized over those other outstanding claims. Then the voices from the public hearing, our government has turned black people against black people, we don't engage in in-depth research and ethnographic studies, we just take my land and give it to another person, or we take their land and give it to us. This has made us poorer because we are running to lawyers all the time. Back then there was Ubuntu, today Ubuntu has been eroded. There is a lack of tolerance in our community. There is tribalism. And then this very poignant statement by a man in KwaZulu-Natal who said, when we were dispossessed, we didn't have farms. Now, before we can get the land back, we're told we must be good farmers. Yet, if something was stolen from me and converted into a bucky, I shouldn't have to pay for the conversion into a bucky. I should just get my car back. So he's saying we should just get our land back. Why are all these conditionalities imposed? But very brilliantly put at the KZN public hearing. So the recommendations are that backlog claims must be resolved before other claims are allowed, that the 1913 cut-off date needs to be retained, and redistribution needs to be used to address all the pre-1913 claims, including claims of the Khoi and Bang community. We recommend that the Land Claims Commission should be made independent of government, as was initially indicated, and that the Land Claims Court must be stabilized with more judges, and that there must be a panel to review the merits of existing claims. Many of those backlog claims are invalid. They've created expectations which can't be met. That there's a need to break up these consolidated mega communities and subdivide the land to the groups who've got specific historical rights. That we need to bring back judicial oversight that their claims can be approved and ensure the claimants are treated equally and that the budget is fairly allocated. So here we did a lot of work, and then there's an annexure L2 and an annexure L3. The one is about a draft restitution bill, and the other is about a bill, an urgent bill, to stabilize the Land Claims Court in the meantime. So then we talk about the role of CPA in trust and land reform, that the master of the High Court has beseeched government to take over the land-owning trust, because the master's office just doesn't have the capacity to deal with all the disputes that are generated within these land-owning communities. So the proposal is that all of those land-holding entities should become CPAs, and that government capacity needs to be set aside to support these entities. That we need a proper budget and costing plan, and that we need strong family and individual rights recorded within the CPA, just as we need strong rights recorded within communal areas. So we need strong rights recorded within CPA so that people have the capacity to hold committees to account. And that we talk about regulations, urgent regulations that could achieve this, but with the land records bill as a longer term solution. And that basically we need more staff capacity and training. And here we talk about just the fact that many of the people have lumped together, they've got competing pains, and that the state's response to the failures of agricultural production has been to impose these strategic partners, which has led to people having no agency. And people really spoke out about this in the hearing. They hate these strategic partners. And there's the urgent need to break up and subdivide the functional CPAs and the need for a land rights protector.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kirsten. Honourable members, we have been listening to the presentation. Any seeking clarity questions? On the presentation, as I've indicated, that this is laying the foundation process. What we're going to engage on this report. Honorable Walters, Honorable Robinson, Honorable Matthias, Honorable Papama, Honorable Sistane, Honorable Mandela, Honorable Mbuni, Honorable Robinson.
Chair, I'm the good-looking one. Chair, look, I think, first of all, I think this is one of the presentations we had in this committee that pulls together a huge number of strains. I think it puts it in a historic context, and I think it also puts the issue of rights. And what I like about it looks at citizens' rights and how it needs to be extended in the land space. And maybe just an anecdote from my side as well, which supports what has been said. I happen to know that in the late 90s, the Agricultural Research Council looked at the potential, agricultural potential on communal land, and with very simple interventions, coupled with clear recording and recognition of rights, I know that a 20-fold or 25-fold increase in productivity in some crops were possible. You know, that's just in the agricultural space. So I think the notion of recording and institutionalizing the rights of people and having the institutional capacity to deliver on it within a short space of time, I think is a very fundamental concept. And I also believe that the various bills that's been proposed actually aims to pull, amongst other things, that together. So just in terms of a question of clarity, and I do have an expectation, certainly from my side, that we will continue to engage in more detail with this. You mentioned in terms of the way you believe legislation failed to comply with a regional constitutional duty. I would like you went through your presentation quite fast, if you can maybe just expand on that. Because I do think that that's in a sense a historical obligation as well, that's part of the expectations that we have around land reform. And then another question of clarity, you mentioned the failing institutional framework, you mentioned inconsistencies in legislation. Is there, you only touched in the presentation on what you consider what a successful business model, and I know it's not just agriculture, but it's partly what we as a committee look at. What would you regard as, call it, the key success factors in a successful agricultural business venture?
Thank you.
Having said that, I think Chair, we raised it previously in the committee as well. A part of the land reform space is that many new claimant in a whether it's a restitution or redistribution setting, and I also like the distinction that was raised. I think it's often confused in our own debates as well. Whether in that setting you considered in the high-level panel report the issue of it being a start-up business, not just a successful venture being taken over and all things continuing, but it's in fact a totally new venture, a totally new set of people, a new business environment. From that perspective, I just want to hear what the high-level panel also discussed. Did you look at what potential models should be in place and what potential support there should be for, call it, the startup phase of a land reform situation or intended enterprise that you want to get off the ground?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the Professor for this presentation. There's a couple of things that jumped out at me when I read it and hearing it from you now as well. Issues, you kept on mentioning issues from province to province as you visited. Province to province, issues of corruption, issues of a lack of training, an obvious lack of training and capacity, the reducing of budgets specifically for land allocation, which was specifically worrying to me, and ploughing those budgets into your agri-parks, etc. I'd like to know a little bit more about that, whether now or even after the panel. But you keep referring back to Section 25, and Section 25 is a debate, as you all know, that we're all having right now, whether it needs to be amended or not. If you are speaking about these inherent failures, corruption, lack of training, do you believe that Section 25 is actually an impediment for the slow allocation of land to black South Africans? I think it's quite a pretty direct question. I think everybody needs an answer to. In your opinion, in the high-level panel opinion, do you think that is actually the Section 25 that is an impediment? And then you also mentioned Mala Mala. Now, Mala Mala was something that we discussed last year on this portfolio committee, and I was led to believe, and the panel was led to believe, that it was merely an issue of beneficiaries that had not been... It was merely an issue of beneficiaries not being verified correctly. Now, after reading the high-level panel report, it actually indicates that both the commission and other stakeholders have indicated that the claim was not valid. Can you elaborate on that as well, please? I'm very keen to know that, because that is 1.1 billion rand of taxpayers' money that seems to be thrown in a direction where it shouldn't have been thrown, in my opinion. Your assessment of CBAs and what's actually happening currently with CBAs and restituted land, especially agricultural restituted land, is spot on, in my opinion. Through my many travels to different CBAs, it has always been the same problem. And I always find situations where there are families that are capable of agriculture, they're capable of farming, they're doing very well, but usually it's a small segment or a small piece of the entire property that's actually functioning, while the rest are still heavily reliant on the state. I totally agree with you that there needs to be subdivision, so that those that can farm can carry on and not get cast under this blanket. It's imperative that South Africans that can succeed must be allowed to succeed. I think that I've gone through most of it. I think that's all for now. I'll ask a supplementary question.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Well, you are cautioning us that there will be thorough discussions later, but we need to use this opportunity for thorough questions, am I right? But that is limiting. It's limiting in the sense that deprive us of engaging on other areas of work. But perhaps just as a starter, I'm happy that Professor Flaxman is in one of his presentations here has capably illustrated different systems of ownership, contrasting Western system with customary system or systems of land ownership. And I think that's the basis of the dispute or contradiction in this country. That's the fundamental source of conflict of around land ownership. Because of the two. The Western system of land ownership, which is essentially English, Roman, Dutch law, which fits various instruments of laws, one of which is mercantile law and other various forms of law, which justifies this Western system of ownership. And this is a system of ownership which over all of these years, since 1652, history which of course I must not belabor you into that history, but just to underscore one point, that is this system that has hegemonized itself and describes its broader jurisdiction over this country, over forms and patterns of land ownership, from colonial, apartheid, and even post-apartheid dispensation, today as we speak. And for as long as we don't go to the heart of this, that we need to deal with the hegemonic dominance of this system, we are far from achieving equitable land distribution in this country. I don't know if you would want to reflect on that much further. And secondly is the customary system of land ownership. That system has no empirical evidence, because all that which was evidence of the existence of this system was destroyed with the arrival of colonial settlers in this country. So it's a system that has got no empirical evidence we can base any argument on. And it lacks jurisdiction, it lacks hegemony, because it's dominated by English Roman Dutch law. And English Roman Dutch law is the law of the day, the law of business. Just as English is the law of business, is the language of business rather, just as Afrikaans in the Boer Republic, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal was the language of business, so is the English Roman Dutch law. So what is the role of customary law in this country insofar as land ownership is concerned? We'll engage further in the discussion. You may say that I'm a little bit unfair, but I just want to stress the discussion much wider through the permission of the chair, of course. But lastly, I agree with the observation that the highest level panel observation that we have made, that over the last 24 years, land has been arbitrarily allocated to elites, to political elites. If we have to do a desktop investigation, how many of all former ministers have had land bought it by themselves, by their own capital, or used state capital? You find none of them can escape that test. They are beneficiaries of what we have described as every capture of land, for which we agree with that observation, but we want to take this much further and deal broadly with various forms of land ownership and patterns of tenure in this country, historically, and say what measures should be taken to correct that. Because we make a very cogent submission as where we come from, the economic freedom fighters, that land must be restored and must be placed under state ownership, just as the mines and mineral resources are placed under state ownership through the act that you mentioned in the document, Minerals and Petroleum Act. In a similar way, land must be placed under the state ownership and state custodianship on behalf of all people. You know why? To deal with different forms of which are discriminatory in their nature. One, feudal or semi-feudal forms of land ownership and pattern of tenure, which are found elsewhere in rural communities, which enables and gives justification for different tribes to put claim on land ownership. That's the first form of discriminatory and exploitative form and pattern of land ownership and tenure, which must be dealt with. Secondly, is colonial and apartheid racist form and patterns of land ownership, which give justification for racial claim over land ownership by the likes of the Freedom Front and others, justifying exclusive rights over land on the basis of colonial apartheid patterns.
Thirdly,
and which is the last point, is capitalist forms of land ownership which give rise to the concept of private ownership of land. And we say all of these forms, which are discriminatory and exploitative, can only be resolved fundamentally, genuinely, substantially, through expropriation of land without compensation, and place land under the state ownership and custodianship on behalf of all of us to bring to an end all these forms of exploitative and discriminatory land ownership and tenure.
Another one, Papa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to say that, as the professor said, some of the panel members actually went backstage to cry. I must say that's the way I'm feeling right now, to think that so much exploitation of our own people can happen by our own black people is really, I really feel emotional about this. It is wrong, it is injustice, it is despicable, actually. But to carry on with the clarification questions, Professor, you said in your presentation on policy and legislative impediments to tenure security, I just need you to explain to me, when they say currently insecure property rights must be treated as, they must be treated as property rights. So rights of people who are currently on the land must be treated as property rights. What do we mean by that? What do we mean by property rights? And then in the same document on page 9, you said the previous minister is actually in breach of fiduciary and legal obligations. If you can just explain that a little bit further. In the other presentation, Parliamentary Oversight Proposed Land Framework Act, on page 8, it says the relatively few people who do manage to obtain redistribution of land remain tenants of the state with conditional use rights subject to productivity. Now,
The previous minister, Gwindi, is on record as saying people are not ready to own land. It was actually on Hansard, whoever, you know, people can go back on Hansard and see that. And also, this is not said, but it's implicit in what is happening, that the belief that blacks cannot farm. Now, I would like you to just explain to me, is that the impression that the high-level panel got when you were going around the different provinces, that people are not ready to actually own land and that black people cannot farm? The last question I have, if I can find it. Oh yes, it's on the restitution of land rights and CPA. You say in on page, there isn't a page here, but it's the model of big groups getting large farms. Could you give me, if you can please, if you can get an example, where people were lumped into, you know, conflicting people were lumped into one big group to settle on a farm. If you don't remember a case, it's fine, but I'd just like to have one case, if you have. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to share. We're obviously dealing with quite a wide and complex matter here, which needs quite a lot of cross-referencing if we must do justice to it. I have tried to do that in the little space of time that we've got at our disposal. Chair, I hope you would bear with me if two or three of my questions are actually directed at the department, because there have been a couple of instances where Dr. Klassen has forthrightly indicated to us as a committee that the department failed to perform. And it's on that basis that I would be directing this to the department. If the procedure of the day does not allow the department to respond, as long as there will be an opportunity for them to respond, because these are critical questions. They go right into the heart of the matter in some instances. I've numbered the documents as documents 1, 2, and 3 according to the sequence that was followed when they were presented. And I will clearly indicate when I refer to a given page that is on document 1. Starting with page 14 of document 1, where you make the allegation that redistribution has been disproportionate. Rich are benefiting rather than the poor. And my question is, do you have evidence of this where you could cite a number of definitely proven cases? Because this is quite a crucial matter, you know, when it comes to policy implementation. I would be happy if at some point we would have that kind of proof, points a finger at the department and government in particular. On page 17, it's not a question, it's a comment. My understanding is that these partners that you refer to there, that you say are in a number of cases imposed by the department, my understanding is that their choice is based on the presupposition as you said, it's normally white people, white farmers, on the presupposition that they know more about commercial farming, if you like, rather than black people, because although they might have been operating farming, it would have been just on a self-serving basis, not commercial, you know, not commercial. So my understanding is that that was the justification for bringing them in. But what has happened is that a lot of criminality, call it fraud, has crept in, according to what we had when we went there, you know, when around the country. And that was the main objection. Not that they, those white farmers, experienced farmers, are in themselves not capable of assisting. maybe you might want to comment, maybe your in-depth research has revealed otherwise, because I don't want us to run away from the fact that there is a certain section of our population which has the advantage of practicing and, if you like, perfecting the art of commercial farming. And then, just because so many of them, or a few of them, have gone into corruption, then we say blanketly, let's disregard them and throw them out the window. I don't want that kind of us to come to that kind of conclusion. And on the front page of document one, your very first sentence says lack of policy coherence, no white paper since 1997. This is the first question directed at the department. The question is simply, why have you been lacking in developing policy when there was so much cry out there for so long, virtually 20 years, no refinement of the policy? And on page 22 of that same document, I had a question as to what sort of rights and powers do you think the rights protector should have. I realize that later you have indicated what sort of functions they should perform. But would you say that proposed rights protector should be at the level equivalent to that of the public protector? Would you say they should play the role of being a mediator? It looks like there's more role for mediating rather than, of course, in the context of protecting the rights, rather than being arbitrary, and therefore instructing institutions like Parliament or something to implement that. That's why I'm asking this question, in spite of the recommendations that you've got in Document 3. Dealing with the post-settlement, you cited the example of the wool growers in the Eastern Cape. I'm quite aware of that organization. What do you think is the reason for failure of institutions like CPOs when it comes to agriculture as in planting vis-a-vis wool growers? People who just take care of their sheep, shed them, and then take wool to Port Elizabeth. Where do you think the problem arises when it comes to planting crops? Because this is where we seem to be having a problem vis-a-vis this kind of operation. And on document 2, page 5, is a PTO classified as an informal right to land? I'm thinking about the Ingonyama Trust, in this case. Your answer will help to enlighten. This is an information-seeking question, so that we can correctly place it. On page 9 of the same document, Ingonyama Trust Act only confines its consultation to traditional leaders. I think this is in section 2 of the Act. Now, according to me, this puts to question as to whether the IPLA Act is constitutionally, is not in conflict with the Ingonyama Trust. Which of the two then is constitutionally compliant? Because your concern there is that they ignore the IPLA So my concern is whether that's the one that should be upheld, IPILRA, or whether the Ingonyama Trust, Act is the one that they are supposed to comply with. That's why I want to know whether the IPILRA Act is, constitutionally binding, insofar as this particular aspect of it is concerned. Page 13, same document.
Yes. This is directed.
Is that the last one?
That last one. I'll try to pass.
Less comments, yeah. To the minister, why are you not implementing this IPILRA Act? Because there have been constant complaints that you're not doing that. I'll skip this one. there's a concern that is expressed about the Ngonyama Trust imposing, wanting to convert to leases with the benefit of them collecting rental. And my question here is, why would Ngonyama Trust be treated differently from municipalities? Municipalities raise rates on property owners, so they have got capital with which to implement services like cleaning and so on. Why would the Ngonyama Trust be prohibited from collecting, setting itself up to collect revenue from people who occupy land? I'm saying this being fully aware of what was stated in the opening sentence of Section 2, of this Establishment Act, that they are there to administer for the benefit of the people. And I believe municipalities do the same exactly in order to administer the cities and towns for the benefit of the people. Page 11 of the third document, why do you recommend specifically that the 1913 cut-off should be observed? That's a critical one. And the last one, Chair, to the department again. If you look at Section 2.7, subsection 7 of the Ngonyama Trust Act, you will find that it gives you, as a department, the exception insofar as you treat the land of under Ngonyama Trust. Says in spite of that, you are allowed to implement programs. Now my question is, have you tried as a department to implement any programs on Ngonyama Trust that, in parentheses, they found themselves tempted to move towards leasing so that they can have revenue with which to improve the lives of the people? Have you tried to impose, to implement any program in terms of Section 2.7 of their Establishment Act? If you're not, then place them offside such that now they are tempted to use other methods to generate revenue for themselves. Thanks for your patience, sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable
Sitana.
Can I request members that the department to be here, I think they are here as observers. Mm-hmm. They've come to listen, to smile, to nod their head, but not to participate. They are coming, their time is coming. But I request members to ask seeking clarity questions from Dr. Anika Trussell. You can just write the questions that are related to the department inside so that when time comes, then raise those questions. Honorable Magada, then Honorable Magela, Honorable Chabeling, Honorable Ngoni will be the last one.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Yes, explain Tara to Chairperson that the Parliament is still going to discuss the report of the panel. Prof, your panel presentation mostly touched to what we got in our public hearing. More especially when talking about land disposition. It touches our hearts as this is a sad history of South Africans where people were killed and children turned as slave laborers in order to take the land forcefully. I agree with Honorable Matthias when he's saying that let's deal with this hegemonic system and discriminatory because it's still existing in a way. There was a comment from Honorable Papama. If the minister said that blacks are not ready to farm and say that in records, that is totally incorrect and unacceptable. And I completely deny it. through you, Chairperson, Prof, you've touched the issue of elite culture as one of the failures. All of us, Prof, were failed people. All of us. There was this land expropriation without compensation. I think that's a correct right for us, in order for us, for the people to access the land in an equitable basis. I think the correct way is expropriation without compensation. Another issue, Chairperson, I thought the high panel will touch with in the issue of title deeds. All over the scandal of provinces that we visited, there was an issue of title deeds. And lastly, Chairperson, there's an issue of selection criteria. As a committee, we are always raising that fact that is still to be discussed with the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. And good morning, Chadine. Honorable DM and his team. And especially thank you to Professor Clarkson. You have said quite a mouthful of summarizing key things of this high level panel report. I think this requires of us quite extensive discussions, and Chair have indicated today will not be the day, but I want to appeal that we create that space to have these discussions, Chair. But Chair, I wish to respond to one statement that has been made, which I am firmly of the view that it's probably taken out of context. There's no way that I can imagine that the Minister William Kunti would make a statement that says black people are incapable of farming. There's no way. I think what we must also understand and acknowledge, because we are saying that whites historically are the best farmers, what we fail to acknowledge is the fact that white farmer success was on the carcasses of black people. What we fail to accept and understand is that the success of white farmers have been to enormous aid by the government, you know, not by their own imaginations, Chair. They have been supported throughout, virtually buying, stealing the land, if one can put it like that. Land taken, they had no reason to invest in land because government have provided land for them. You know, if you go through the history, you will clearly see that. But we need to take that kind of history into consideration, Chair. But I am very, very much, the comment you quoted, Prof, from a person in KZN who clearly said that this presumption, it's expected that when you get land, you must do farming, you know, yet you can do anything else with the land. That person is saying the fact that my land has been stolen does not mean that when I get my land back that I must now farm, because he's saying only if you are given land, that's the only thing you can do with land. I've read an interesting book which the title is What to Do with Land. Clearly questioning, I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done with land. And perhaps the whole notion of farming is perhaps a Western imposition, a chairperson. I am very, very much concerned, Chair, or let me just say, a proverb raised the issue of a great a question mark around the restitution claim of Malamala, and I agree we need to have more information with regard to that. We can't allow it just to be said and nothing is done about that, Chair. I'm very much worried about the leanings of the high-level panel that says that the aspirations, the wishes of people who consider themselves to be the first people of this country, descendants of the Khoi and Son, are being told in terms of this report and the recommendations, that their aspirations will remain what it was. They have been hoping when the Restitution Amendment Act was passed or it was considered that there would be provisions made for them. It was not. Yes, there are special policy provisions that still to be made. But if the high-level panel come out so strongly and says no, that would be literally killing that aspirations. That's what I read into what you were saying. I think that is something that certainly should be revisited, Chair. I'm also concerned about the high-level panel have made very, very widespread, concrete analysis of the abilities and inabilities of the department. I'm not quite sure, there's no indication that there has been any form of discussion between the high-level panel and the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. The same one here, the utterances of Ifilo, King Gudu's Valentini, then clearly it means that there has also not been any engagement between the high-level panel and King Gudu's Valentini as the single trustee. Chair. I certainly, as a ANC member, employee, and as a, in my own personal capacity, support much of what's being said in relation to the IT. Chair. That cannot be denied. But one would have expected that the high-level panel composed of such individuals with extreme high integrity would have made time to engage with important stakeholders and not just make findings without even engaging them. I think, Chair, with respect, I think that is a weakness in the reporting process if that hasn't happened, Chair. And also, I do get a sense, I may be wrong, Jay, that we are talking about a Western-based model of land ownership where ownership is vested in the hands of individuals or families, Chair. But historically, even if one goes back 400 or 500 years, we will always find that in this continent, land has been shared and by communities. I say now, the whole issue of the ownership that is for me a concern. I would agree that people living on the land that they should own the land communally. I would want you to also respond to the notion that that Honorable Matthias have raised that says that the land ownership must be in the hands of the state, you know, and I'm sure what he meant is that the state holds ownership on behalf of the people, you know, that I would and I'm quite sure he's not talking about any form of elitism, Chair. I also want to say there's a lot of, I mean, this committee will support right from the outset the whole idea of trust, you know, in trust being converted to CPAs. My question would be, Chair, the CPA Act are in the process of being amended. Whether the high-level panel have looked at the proposed amendments and whether they have thought that those amendments are in line with their thinking and their way, and whether they should not perhaps try to convince us, even at this late stage, consider some clauses that, or some ways of strengthening the amendment bill, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me use this opportunity to thank Dr. Klassen for giving us a big mirror to look at ourselves, and we thank you. I'm not going to repeat what other people said in terms of the other questions that Ms. Klassen, but I think I need to repeat this one. The method was made by Honorable Magaza on the utterances of Honorable Obama about the alleged statement that was, you know, issued by the minister that black people are not ready to own land. I would request that to maybe tell us which hands are at and in which meeting, so that we can, in a way, go back to the minister, ask him to retract what he said, because I don't think it's right. And it's unlike the minister. I don't definitely think of him saying that the black people are not ready to own land. And people who are really concerned about the plight of the landless, it's us, the ANC and the EFF and all other parties that voted for the expropriation of land without compensation. Those who are against it are people who are not necessarily interested in resolving the land.
Chair, it's a point of order, and I would like you to rule on it. It's a point of order. He suggested that parties who voted against the proposed resolution for the motion in Parliament don't care about land reform. That's patently untrue. The evidence in front of us suggests that the opposite is true. So, Chair, we're happy to debate the matter in front of us. It's not these types of interactions.
The matter has been debated. The motion was passed. This is a committee. And Honorable Chabileng, I think, raised his own view on the matter. I think sometimes we need to be tolerant about other people's view, whether we agree with the view or don't agree, just to listen. Because really, we can't debate everyone's view. When Honorable Matia says something, you want to respond, you jump. When Honorable Magaza says something, you want to respond. Can you be calm? Can we?
Yeah, I'm very calm. I don't believe that topic. My second point of order, I don't believe commenting on the motion in Parliament is actually the matter in front of us. So can you stick to the matter on the agenda?
Land expropriation, Honorable Walters, was mentioned also by Dr. Klassen. So we can't separate land expropriation from
other. Chair, I'm happy with you.
And also the Constitution. Dr.
Chancellor,
talk about land expropriation without compensation. Section 25.
Chair, I'm happy with your ruling.
Okay. I'm also happy that you understand.
You're not being alive,
Madam Chair,
Honourable Cabinet.
You must admit that I'm the one who reprimanded him now.
Thanks, Honourable Matthias, for assisting me. Honourable Cabinet.
Yes, Chairperson, they say that the sometimes it's hidden and at other times it's in the open. So it's been hidden for a long time. But since that book, everybody knows where parties stand when on relation to an entry board. And I just want to check with Dr. Glasser. Have you ever looked at the possibilities of you know, the state taking over the land? That is the land invested in the hands of the state, like with mineral rights. That we nationalize the land, and then the government would work for that in terms of how do people access land. And I think that would be the highest form. The best resolution to all this, land-related challenges for the country. Thank you, Chairperson. But at the same time, I just want to say before I say that the land, we say the land should belong to those who live on it. The land should belong to those who work it. And that, in the words of Joshua Nkomo in Zimbabwe, when he was interviewed, he once said that the war is about land. And private ownership of the land is foreign ideology. And I think if we nationalize the land, it's going to, we don't even have to go through this other legislation that we are dealing with. Thanks, Chairperson.
Yes.
Another one,
thank you, Chair. I join colleagues to appreciate the presentation by Dr. Glasson. For now, I say Dr. Glasson. I'm aware of the disadvantages of the either saying prof or doctor if it's the other way. I've got numerous examples. One high-level politician had to resign on office because we called him doctor, and everyone said doctor, and ultimately it went back to him. You're calling yourself doctor, and very sad day indeed, because they're now standing later to this day. So I know I should be very particular about titles. And the reverse is also a big spin also. Chair, I just wanted to acknowledge a small gesture by Dr. Glasson that she being a white person to then come and talk about land. It was just a small statement in passing. It's very, very significant. It's very significant. Because to the heart of what the president calls the original sin is also the race question, the gender question, the class question, and so forth. The dispensation since 1652 up to 94, and informally up to now, up to 94 officially and statutorily, was based on this. Sometimes in Parliament you get a sense, even when I sit in the House, that to even ever mention a race, to say I'm an African, could be a big point out of the dispensation. It's the correct point. We're not going to wipe away over three centuries history in 24 years in office and think that race is no longer an issue. It's a very, very profound disclaimer or whatever you may wish or delimitation you wanted to. I acknowledge it, Prof, and at the expense of my time, because I can't speak forever yet. I really acknowledge it, because there are biases, there are values, there are what are, there are upbringings, and there are all these. And no one is neutral. Everyone has got value propositions. We grew up in our communities, our families, and elsewhere. But we also must acknowledge that some white people have really done so much justice to efforts to have justice in this country.
Yes.
And they have been very, very outstanding. Bears Norden in the churches, Joe Slovo in the political movement. Up to the present, in fact, even some of our colleagues, sometimes they are frowned on by the opposition benches, some of those white fellows like the Honorable Jeremy Cronin, Honorable Williams, and others.
because it's as though, but you know, why are you arguing the black case? And they have to, because their level of consciousness, they represent a new person beyond and above race. And I am saying, you can't talk land without talking race in South Africa, not in the conjunction, not even in our lifetime, even the youngest person in the room. When you talk land, you'll be talking simultaneously, and hidden and analyzed will be the race question. But thanks to the white people who continue to stand on the right side of history, and without really giving you much proof, I think you really raising your hand up to be counted on the correct side of the history. And thank you for the good work you do. You'll agree as academic that you would expect us to engage. You would not expect us to take everything you have said as Bible. And we will do exactly that. We will engage. Chair, the parliamentary process, I'm the whip, I don't know how I deal with my member next to me here. There's a parliamentary process. And that parliamentary process led to the establishment of the High Level Panel. And while we were discussing CPA amendment a month ago, then this today was born out of that. Colleagues felt and unanimous in the committee that let's get a taste of what the High Level Panel is saying, the recommendations specifically dealing with the land part of all the review that the High Level Panel was dealing with. In particular, there was this issue that you proposed in the moratorium on almost everything. I have been privileged enough to initiate a legislation on restitution. It's somewhat softly on ice, and I'm very, very hot under the collar about that ice on which a restitution amendment bill, because Concord expects us in July, now hardly 4 months from now, to come back with a reformulated restitution amendment bill, and having been passed, and I am really, really managing my temper as to why restitution amendment is not flying. I introduced it in Parliament about October last year. This is now 5-6 months down the line. It's nowhere. So, in part, Prof. Dr. Klassen, you get the impression that it's because High Level Panel said stop everything. And we passed the High Level Panel was in existence, we passed EFTA amendment. And I can stand up as the whip, also representing the committee and my party, the ANC, and be proud that with that EFTA amendment, it's going to be very difficult to evict the 2.8 million people on the farms because it's been tightened up everything. We're doing the same with CPAs. The 1,502 CPAs will now be somewhat regulated and minimize the problem there with the Office of the Registrar of CPAs and so forth. I know these are issues you work with that day in, day out. But I'm just saying, there has been all the work that is being done by Parliament. I just want to visit your proposition somewhere that there's no white paper. I don't know if it felt like that. Maybe I'm vandalizing it. I then checked, I found the white paper of 1997. I then checked on land reform. I then checked and found the green paper of 2011. So I thought that these overarching policy guides are there. They might just need some tweaking here and there. So I do think that maybe you went too hard, because when I listened, I thought, we don't have. So it's just statutes one after the other without any kind of a green paper, white paper. I did pick up a white paper of 97 and a green paper of 2011. But with that, maybe in the form of a direct question, are you satisfied that you consulted with the department? Now, we oversight the department. So when you take up the ammunition, so to speak, and actually go direct to the department and say, hey, wow, there's this. Are you satisfied that in the course of your consultations and public hearings, you did meet with the department, be it the ministry, be it the high-ranking officials,
the CLCC that she is over there smiling nicely. She's been disturbed now. The CLCC and other people, Leona, acting DG, and everyone, did you have a chance to sit with them and to hear them out? I just want to show a slight contention, but not adversarially, on the RADP. Now, the former DG, would put it nicely, I don't know if I can go verbatim, but I was still grappling with issues then of this portfolio. Say, the RADP, is there the recapitalization, is there to rekindle the class of 1913, the class of black farmers who were destroyed by the 1913 Land Act? Full stop. Something like that now. If you do it listening from someone, you may not hit at me, to the best of my ability. That's how he would sum up. And I bought to that definition. Back in 1913 Land Act and other draconian measures, and then all that black farmers, there were black farmers with 200, 300 heads of cattle, and the Land Act and everything squashed them, squeezed them, squashed them, squeezed them, squashed them, squeezed them, up and out of existence. So the RADP seeks to rekindle, as a former DG would put it. So put differently, viewed from another angle, it's in that trade and industry.
Yeah.
A trade and industry, they are busy with the black industrialist program. To say, why do you want jobs at the lower end of the market? But the white end remains really white, so to speak. Unless if you begin to deliberately spring some black industrialists so that you temper also with the commanding high. So in my view, I want to say, Prof, when you respond, I don't know if I'll still be in the room, would you think that it's an anomaly while you are building the small emerging farmer to also, at the high end of food production in this country, introduce black farmers so that whatever food you buy at, I don't even want to mention those stores, you buy at whatever the regular chain stores, who have such high quality products, that there is such a, from the, they are black. And Chair, I want to step aside on the RADP. You'll agree, Chair, we had a 3-day workshop last year at Good Hope on this. We were impressed when a young farmer, he was from Mpumalanga, came and said, I'm the success story of the RADP. So I'm just saying, Dr. Glasson, maybe the RADP and such other programs across government departments that seek to spring some black people into the commanding heights of the economy, so that if there's a black pilot in driving a plane, no one should panic and think that I will not reach my destination, as an example. This thing about the RADP, if you do away with it altogether, there might just be some Chair, last point. It links with my earlier point, Chair. The high-level panel was a panel mandated by the speakership on behalf of Parliament. Perhaps there is going to be, and I'm inviting colleagues to think through this. Okay, let me not even say perhaps. There is going to be a parliamentary process to look into the holistic work of the high-level panel. The high-level panel went into schools and education, went into health, went into the economic development, went into everything else. So the high-level panel's report has got, like a report from the department and the commission, has got to go through the parliament, like a proposed budget, and then parliament unfolds process to test that and to adopt, right? So I'm just saying, perhaps in terms of process, but also for the benefit of, I'm not making media statement, but for the benefit of the public to understand that the high-level panel maybe will preempt a little bit as one committee to seek to engage. It should be a parliamentary-wide process to engage in it. But we really appreciate it, John Collins. We really appreciate it. Thanks for all the efforts by the panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Clausen, I hope you've been noting, and I will request that when you respond, you just be specific on the issues that have been raised. But can I propose to honorable members that we have 5 minutes break in time to speak?
Thank you. Thank you. Do you think I don't?
Honourable members, Dr. Johnson, can I then give you this opportunity to respond? But before that, can I just, I noted some few issues that I wanted to raise here. The issue as raised by Honourable Mandela of consultation of various stakeholders, and also the issue of what is your view on the issue of the CCA amendment which you are dealing with currently. Do you think that will solve the problems that you highlighted in your presentation? You said that the Speaker's Forum mandated you to propose a bill or legislation framework. Can you clarify that? Because according to me, the ad hoc committee was just a committee dealing with a specific, was formed for a specific table. Now the task has been done, there's no high level panel any longer. If you can just clarify that.
Over to you, Jessica.
Thank you very much, and thank you also for this very positive hearing. You know, I'm aware that what we've said is highly critical of the department, and in a way it's highly critical of the oversight that's been exercised by this committee. And so I was expecting a lot more, much tougher reception, and I thank you for that. That it was tough, but not the balance with other points. Okay, I'm going to just go through it chronologically. So the first question from Honourable Walters was, can you clarify which legislation has failed to comply with the Constitution? So basically, Section 25 provides for three land rights. Equitable access, which is 25.5, security of tenure, which is 25.6, and restitution, which is 25.7. There is a gap in relation to 25.5. There are laws in place in respect of restitution, and there are some laws in place in respect of tenure, all the farm worker laws, for example, even though there's a gap in relation to communal tenure. So what we have needed is a law to give teeth to Section 25.5, which is redistribution. And one of my inputs here has been that it's the failure of that part of the program which has backfired on the rest of it. So there's a gap, and that's what the Land Framework Act seeks to propose as a recommendation. Nothing more than a recommendation, because as the Chair has said, the Honourable Panel no longer exists. Everything that we've done is placed before Parliament, and it's for Parliament to decide how to take it forward. The big gap, the one where Parliament very vulnerable in respect of 25.6 and 25.9, because 25.9 says Parliament must enact the law to give effect to Section 25.6. And yet you've got the most vulnerable South Africans who bore the brunt of forced removal with no law to give effect to Section 25.6, other than in Hilra, which is a weak holding mechanism which is not enforced. So that is, I think that's probably one of the most high-level findings of the panel, because we were asked to review legislation passed since 1994 to look at its consequences, positive and negative, and then to propose the amendment, the repeal, or the introduction of laws. So those wasn't in our terms of reference to propose amendments, repeal, an introduction. we went effectively beyond probably our mandate when I had when we had secret forum after to come up with practical solutions. They said we don't want this to go round and round. Actually come up with what the new law that you think needs to be introduced should look like. Then you talk about successful business model. I'm not well qualified to speak about that. My background is legal and rights. We did commission a very excellent paper on the question of agrarian reform by Voltaire. And that paper is on the website. And it sort of documents all the different approaches that there have been to agricultural production. And it's a very depressing paper because it says that in the end they all defaulted to farming on the model of how the white commercial farmers used to farm, whereas they had been highly subsidized. They could never have farmed like that without massive state subsidization. So that model doesn't work any longer for white or for black. And what the Voltaire study says is you've got to really provide for a range of different models for the people who come in at the high end and that you know, really large-scale farmers, but also for the people who are already using land, who are struggling, farming. I mean, there are women in the city farming better, and they're making a good livelihood out of it. What are the things that are restricting them from growing that business? What are the legal impediments? What are the marketing impediments? So the Voltaire proposal says you need support at different levels, but you desperately need agricultural extension services at all these different levels. And as long as our vision of agriculture is based on a model of how white farmers used to farm, in a country where we no longer have the subsidies that enable them to farm like that, we really are in trouble. The question of startup businesses, you know, I just want to alert members that there's a chapter in the report on land, but there's also a joint chapter on spatial inequality. Because as we worked in our three different groups, being poverty and inequality, land and social cohesion, we realized that this question of spatial inequality spans all groups. And that this is a massive issue, and it's also linked to people not having recorded rights and not having easily recognized identity in relation to startup businesses. They're not recognized by the formal system. They even struggle to vote because you have to have an address to vote. So there was there's a cross-cutting chapter about how to look at spatial inequality because it is the structural outcome of laws that were designed to exclude people. And it's not something that's going to be fixed by any kind of trickle-down changes. It needs structural intervention to deal with the kind of structural inequality that we inherited from the process. So I just want to refer you to the spatial inequality chapter and the section there on rural spatial inequality, because many of our most urgent recommendations are in that chapter. Then, Honourable Robertson, you asked about Section 25, obviously the big question. You'll have seen that the panel said that it believes that Section 25 has not been a major impediment to land reform, that it sees the lack of political will, corruption, and incapacity as what has really held back land reform. And basically, as a panel, we agreed that expropriation at much less than market value and even for nothing is possible within the parameters of Section 25. And one of the dangers of amending Section 25 is that you lose the land rights, the positive land rights that were included to counterbalance the property right. That said, that's the view of the panel, much debated and unanimous. Personally, I think that this debate about expropriation without compensation has opened up something which is incredibly important, which is the legitimacy of property rights. And the hypocrisy of people claiming that property rights are sacrosanct while the property rights of black people are being routinely interpreted. And I think that that is a very necessary opening up of this question of legitimate speaking. And I think people really need to put their money where their mouth is. I mean, in the olden days, people like Helen Sisson, you know, were fighting sports from New York and trying to stop the destruction of black people's property rights. But we as a society are backed by the mining companies fail to obtain consent and fail to compensate people. And I think we've got to have an approach that says all property rights, not just title deeds, are going to be taken seriously. You asked about the Mala Mala claim. I mean, that issue is very important because it goes back to this question of who was restitution going to be for? So many people who could prove that they were just possessed at a particular time through a discriminatory factor. But the focus has shifted to tribal groups rather than who at that time was occupying the land. Were they actually labor tenants and families, or were they people who had been sort of amalgamated into an identity that put in a land rent? And I think the historical research that was done by one of the people who made submissions to the panel was that there really are fundamental questions about subsuming the kinds of land rights people exercise and practice under this rubric of tribal care. And I think that, you know, we know that expert said that this group wasn't valid and constituted, and if they were valid and constituted, then it wasn't a valid claim, because claim is based on particular people losing land and the nature of the life that they lost at that time. Then, Honourable Matthias, I think this question of the different systems of ownership was probably the most exciting part of the panel. We really had incredible input from Ms. Yabulela Manona about the Land Records Act and the way in which you would have to record rights. One of our rapporteurs was Professor Tamilati Trouble, and they would both argue very strongly that you are incorrect to say that those rights have been destroyed. There's a very famous Kenyan scholar, Kapagenda, who unfortunately has passed away, who's written about the incredible resilience of customs and practices, that despite all these laws that were designed to overlay them and destroy them, you have people still actually practicing forms of land rights at the family level that accommodate other people, and that you've got these strong customary repertoires which have been quite well documented. And the Constitutional Court has looked at this evidence of living customary law and upheld that you've got to look at what people do on the ground. It is completely remarkable that these forms of customary rights have survived the kind of abuse that they have survived. But I would argue that they have survived, and they provide an incredibly powerful starting point to really change this debate about the nature of ownership in South Africa. I'm concerned about the idea of state ownership solving the problem. We've got state ownership of minerals, and it has been a disaster for rural people. They have ended up with their land rights. I mean, black people, when they were removed, often owned the property with the mineral rights intact. After, of course, removal, they get the land back, no mineral rights. Mineral rights are owned by the state, and they're excluded from all these kinds of things. So, sure, a level of state regulation is incredibly important, and maybe even state ownership, but if there are not property rights vested in individuals, we will have the kind of practices that we've seen in the Onyama and in Northwest and in the South. That we've got state ownership of land already, and military is outgunned by the state, and people don't have the right to be able to hold the state to account. If they had the right, then I think that this would get us around the problem of Western model of exclusive ownership, which, as we say, and I completely agree, has become hegemonized to the point that traditional leaders are asking for titles not custody or ownership. I mean, the ironies are really profound, actually. Honorable Papama, what do we mean by property rights? That is the heart of the matter. You don't need title deeds to have property rights. You can have rights. You can have a right in terms of the informal land tenure act, which must be expropriated. So it's not necessarily the land that is getting expropriated, it's your right to it. So once you have a right set out in statutes that says, this is what you can do with the land, and these are the circumstances under which it can be taken away, we have a property right. Property is a much wider concept than title deed ownership. It's very restricted as title exclusive. So we need more people to have property rights, and you can have property rights on state-owned land. There's no contradiction between state as trustee giving away some of its powers to the people who've got those rights, so that the state ownership becomes quite a duty ownership, because once you've got the right to occupy, to use, to leave to your children, that is your property right against the state. You said that I made a striking statement to say the minister is in breach of his fiduciary legal obligations, which I did, and I stand by that, and I would love the minister to see me for saying that, because then I think we could put all of this stuff on the table. Because it's in order by state. It says that where the state is the nominal owner, nothing can be done to the land, to the people who've got property rights in terms of timber without their consent except by appropriation. That is not happening. He has stepped back from his role as mandated by law, and he has stepped back from his fiduciary responsibility to those people as a trustee of their land. It's very similar to what we said about the Ngunnawa Trust Land. The minister treating the land as though he owns it, have no rights on it, but actually he's a trustee, and they do have rights, and he's bound by law. I don't know anything about the statement of the minister saying people are not ready to own land. I can't perform. I don't know anything about it. But it is what the policy says. The policy says that anyone who gets land is in distribution and not own it. Why would you have a policy like that unless there was belief that giving them the land would be a mistake? You asked whether when we went around, we got the impression that people are not ready to own land and that they actually can't farm. Not at all. We met people who want to be farmers to explain how they have been thwarted by all the different changes in policy which keep on changing, how they've actually got the land but then they didn't get the settlement support, and they gave the concrete examples. Some of the big scale farmers, not the small scale farmers, talked about these value chains and how they get locked up by the local co-ops who just make deals with the same farmers they're going to make deals with. And there are ways of regulating. You asked me to give you an example of a conflicting claim. The one that springs to mind is Penbosch, where people kept on talking about problems in Kumulanga. But Dr. Menendez will give you many more examples than I can off the top of my head. But there are many. Honorable Sultani. You asked about the statement about recap disproportionately benefiting the rich and the expensive as well. That is in the DPME report, which the committee processed. Very black and white. So this is not our finding as a panel. We also drew on some of the DPME reports. Dr. Menenke, can you remind me of the name of that report? The one about recap.
Our members have that report too. We dealt about each the recommendations that recap was supposed to be transferred. That report, which is comments which recap must be transferred from rural to data.
And that report was based on them doing quite extensive research. Then you talk about the strategic partners, the discretion of fraud and criminal behavior. I'm not qualified to speak about that, but I do agree that some of them do seem to be sincere, but there are really serious problems in the pattern of who becomes strategic partners, especially some of these multinational companies. But, you know, we didn't hear concrete evidence about that. I'm afraid that I think that the public protector, that the land rights protector would have to be someone like the public protector. Because I was really, really shocked at the scale of the number of people locked into these land reform projects. You know, I actually say our land was better, our lives were better before we got the land, because now we're locked in these insurance. And it's partly explained by quite a few people want money rather than land, because they know how long the process will take and they've seen terms of use. And in a way, even if money is going to get used up, it needs to come out of it with something. When you talk about the wool growers and the sort of relative success of people who farm with animals compared with those who plant with crops, I mean, it just makes me think of Betterment. In the rehabilitation programs of the 60s that went along with the Dutch authorities there. Because if you look at crop farmers then, say in the Eastern Cape, say around Tatamahook, people were farming every inch of their land. But then you got Betterment and people were separated from their fields, people were moved away, and you got this situation where you were allocated fields far from where you lived, where people could steal land. You also had all the subsidization that was going on with the white farmers. I really personally don't think one can point fingers unless you deal with the macro factors that systematically undermined black agriculture, as this was pointed out. You asked about Itilra versus Ngonyama. The Ngonyama Trust Act makes the Ngonyama Trust subject to all land reform legislation. So it's subject to Itilra. Itilra Trust in Ngonyama, because Itilra is national legislation. And the Ngonyama Trust has confirmed this in its annual report. And I think Mr. Nguyen even said so last week when he said, why do we need to have a change, because we're already subject to national land legislation. So it's really a question about how come the department ministry hasn't ensured that we will have a trust abide by the silver. Yes, PTOs are included as one amongst the variety of informal land rights that are protected by silver. And then you spoke about Ngonyama and the municipality, and Ngonyama doesn't have the legal authority to provide services. Only local governments do. And it's not providing services. So, you know, its function is a land administration function, whereas the municipality's function is a service provision function. And, you know, what's extraordinary is that the rent people are paying are for land where there are no services. So if they were paying rates instead of rent, they might be getting services. Why did we preserve 1913? So we did this because restitution was designed to be for people who can prove Christ and how they love him. And we don't think people can will have the same level of proof before 1930. And it's so easy for issues to degenerate into this kind of tribal thing. Plus, the institution is already overburdened. Of course, the painful part of that is what about the coin is that. And I take your point. We have very, very poignant testimony from Khoi and Flan communities. But again, our terms of reference were limited to, you know, laws passed in 1994. We were highly critical of the traditional leadership which we don't think, which treats Khoi San people completely different from how it treats people living before the island act. And so is discrimination. But we do, yeah, we make a rather weak recommendation that that Khoi San land claims should be dealt with through political measures of redistribution, because actually the process of Khoi San redistribution was not really legal. But there are other recommendations in another chapter on social cohesion. And then Honorable Magatha talked about Title Bs. So we are strongly proposing that instead of Title Bs, we use the Land Records Act. We are very, very worried that the Beast Registry is breaking down. You can't deal with the volume of cases. We're also very, very worried that it has the system of one owner. And then you have one owner, and that person can evict everybody else. So Title Deeds just about always discriminate against women. But also for some of the reasons that Honorable Matthias has mentioned, the construct of ownership that they embody is out of sync with how the majority of South Africans live. So we strongly believe that there should be records, but we suppose the land records have to approach today. Then to say that I strongly agree with you about the multiple livelihoods and the methods of farming, that idea that land reform translates directly into agriculture on this old white model of subsidized farming has been a real killer. And there is a lot of evidence to show that if people draw on multiple livelihoods, land can play an incredibly important role. Which is not to say that it should only be at that level. Obviously, we need to protect commercial farmers as well. Discussions with the department. So basically, we had round tables, and when we had a topic like redistribution, we would invite the revenue section of the department to come and address that. So we invited DG in that instance. When we were discussing the restitution, we invited the chief land tenure commission to address that. Similarly, when we were discussing the land tenure. So at the level of the round table, which is where we tested a commission search that we had commissioned, we did invite the department. But more than that, our chair, former President Constante, met Minister Mukwesi. Similarly, with the Bunyama Trust, we invited Mr. Ngwenya and invited the CEO. I personally was not aware that we could invite the king. I sort of assumed that he delegates issues like this not at all. Maybe that was what the general wanted to say, but that really wasn't actually my decision. We also invited Contronesa, we invited the House of Traditional Leaders. One of our members, Dr. Nombende, you know, is very an active speaker for inclusivity, and so we even circulated the minutes of the round table discussions to people who were part of those discussions in case they wanted to dispute any of them. Things that were said in the room. Then the question of the CPA and the industry and the high level panel. Basically, the things that we recommend we place on hold are not Parliament's legislative program. It's only laws that relate to what we identify as the purpose of the legislation. And the crucial ones are the traditional leadership governance framework act, which is not the corporate committee, and the traditional council amendment bill, both of which are before the NCLP. We are very worried about the communal land tenure bill, and we see the CPA amendments as feeding into those. I think some of the provisions in the CPA amendments are really difficult to understand unless you've seen the communal land tenure bill. It's kind of paved the way by saying CPAs will be equal to traditional councils and neither will the owner or the community or the owner. But in that other bill, there is this provision of title. And here again, we come back to this notion of title, piece of ownership, will go to the traditional community, and that will give them the chance to determine what the other rights are. So I personally do think that there are problems with the CPA and many people, but I do think it's something that should be used. I do think those bigger issues of the CLTV should be at least discussed before we finalize the law. I understand that it must be infuriating or have another structure come and interfere with work that you're busy with. And I understand what the Honourable Minister is saying about the institution as well. But that is our mandate, and those are our recommendations. I don't know that there's such a big difference between your bill and the one that we propose. Maybe there's a way of amalgamating it too. Green paper, yeah, there's a green paper in 2011. But a green paper is not a white paper. You know, you want a policy framework against which you can see how restitution would fit with redistribution, fit with serious reform. And I still would say that the committee is at a great disadvantage in being asked to deal with things on such an ad hoc basis, without having a clear picture of the bigger picture and how the components are put together. And I think that that is something that is a structural constraint when we're being able to exist in those. I think I've answered the question Honourable Chamberlain about the state taking over the land. You have to have strong rights to see the people, to hold the state accountable. Because if you just have nationalisation of that, you have what you've got with the NCRDA, which is wholesale corruption. I mean, the department, anyway, I want to go into that. But, yeah, there's really serious questions about who is elected as a BEE shareholder. And it's one of the things that has driven much of what has gone wrong in Lancashire, especially the mining. Then you asked about and talked about Ndu, Shivani. When I looked at that RECAP report, what I saw was that many of the RECAP projects are not RECAP like old failed restitution cases, they were new ones. And sure, it would have produced some good results. But its downfall was that there were no selection criteria, and there was no proper monitoring evaluation. So something that can produce something good has its feet cut off from underneath it, in that it's not, there are no accountability mechanisms. And then it starts being abused in one province or another. I'm sure you would have seen those figures a lot since then, when they launched the assertion in the police station. So sure, we need something that invests in commercial farming, but we need something that Parliament is able to monitor against the new selection criteria and so on. Yes, and just to agree with you as the Chair, our our period now has just come to an end. I'm no longer a member of the high level panel. I'm coming as a former member of the high level panel. We did try and consult with various stakeholders. And I'm as confused as everybody else as to what part of the decision was approved. Because I got the impression that it was being handed over to the different committees, but it seems like there's still some other kind of process. And I just hope that all the work that's in the annexure doesn't go to the commission. It impact on how things are being handled. I think I've answered all the questions, but please denote me if I haven't.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chairperson, honorable members. We are done with this matter. Let me take this opportunity to thank you for honoring our invitation. We are aware that there's no high level panel anymore. The work has been done and finalized, so the high level panel doesn't exist. But there are parliamentary processes that are going to take place to take us to the report, look at the report and guide various committees on the approach to the issues that that were raised by the high level of panel. But I think we keep on communicating. If need be, we'll invite you.
Well, can I just say that I'm really glad that our work is in your hands. I can't think of a better committee
Thank you very much. Honourable members, can we continue with our business? Or can I choose to protect the person with other engagements? Can we proceed with our next item on the agenda? I think it will be a short item with other members. So, yes, so we're not here again.